Well, welcome. This is Nan Evans, and I'm here today with my co-hosts for Nature Now, Debron Kelso and Mary Robeson. And if you happen to catch our show from last week, you would know that we celebrated our 500th program show. We had such a good time that we decided we would do part two of our celebration of the 500th. There'll be a conversation, there'll be clippings from past shows, a few mystery sounds, and music at the end, of course. So let's listen to the first mystery sound. And it's a little different because part of the job could be to identify, and I think there are five creatures making sounds on it, but most importantly, what are they doing? What are they communicating to each other?
Well, given what we've been talking about with Scott Brinton, it should be of no surprise. Those five species that we just heard were all sending alarm calls. The first one was an American robin's peek and tut. Those alarms are often used when there is a threat near the nest. The second call was a dark-eyed juncle's tss, 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 and it's a subtle, quiet alarm call. The common yellowthroat gave the third chuck call, indicating that there was trouble nearby. We also heard the mew and chip of the spotted towhee, and then lastly, the squawk of the American crow. That recording, by the way, was made as a group of crows were mobbing a human being, making field recordings of bird vocalizations. All those calls certainly sound like the birds are using exclamation points.
Well, and that was the mystery sound we used for a program with Scott Brinton from the Cedar Root Folk School about bird language. And we're going to hear just a bit of that program now.
So bird language is listening to the birds for the nuanced messages on what their vocalizations, how that's broadcasting different movements through the forest. So whether there are predators in the area, aerial predators or ground-dwelling predators, the birds will set off a series of alarms that moves through the forest that you can pick up on just with a little dirt time and practice. So it's quite a bit different than learning individual vocalizations of birds. And I've found folks who have a really difficult time learning individual vocalizations being able to pick up on bird language much easier because it's a series of patterns that replicate between any species of bird.
But sounds like you're talking about that next step of communication, what the birds are saying to each other about what's going on in the habitat, sort of a level of awareness that's the next step beyond just knowing the name. Is that a way to think about
it? Yes, exactly. And you can simply break down the bird language into five different voices.
Do you want to do that for us?
Sure. So you have songs, but then you also have where they are communicating, companions will communicate back and forth to each other. So it'll be a little more of a rhythmic back and forth that you can pick up on. So whether it's a juvenile and a mom moving around feeding, but there'll be a back and forth communication that's essentially, where are you? I'm over here.
Oh.
Are you still there? Yeah, I'm over here.
What's the difference between the companion call and the songs?
So the song is more a inspiration in the morning time. You'll hear them belting out, whether that is, I'm not personally in the body of a bird, that it's a heralding of a new day. There's some territory stuff that happens with songs. So you have that, and you have the companion call. Then you have, in the springtime, when there is territories being set up, there's a male-to-male aggression.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a juvenile begging call that comes after the chicks get born. Those are the voices that become the baseline in the forest. If you hear any of those, you know that there is not a Cooper's hawk around, because they will not have any of those behaviors. They won't be rhythmically calling back and forth, "Where are you? I'm over here." It will be more run.
This is Deborah and Kelso, and our next clip is from one of my favorite shows, recorded back in February 2016 with our guest, Dr. Jerry Freilich. He had just retired as research coordinator for the Olympic National Park, and he spoke with us on one of his favorite topics, bees and biodiversity.
Most biodiversity, most species that have been named so far, are insect species. Insects account for a huge number of the species that exist. Today, I'd like to talk to you about bees. And I would make the point that if I showed you a picture with five families of bees,
it would all look
like they're all the same. I mean, not the same, they're different, but our English language doesn't help us. To our common language, they're just bees. Now, when I ask people to name how many kinds of bees they can name, most people will say, okay, honeybees, mason bees, bumblebees, and that's about it. So it's always a shock to learn that there are somewhere between, say, 3 and 4,000 species of native bees in North America.
That's just astonishing.
The bees and wasps and ants are all Hymenoptera. But bees and wasps are totally different. And the wasp world is hundreds of times larger than the bee world. The bees are a specialized group of wasps.
And when did the bees evolve?
Okay, the bees came about sometime around the time when dinosaurs were disappearing, 100 million years ago. And this is around the same time that flowering plants started to diversify, right at that time. And as flowering plants started to diversify, the bees started to diversify also. So by the time you come to the Paleocene and the dinosaurs are now extinct, at that point now we have bees and bees and bees and bees. But again, remember, the bees, they are a much smaller world than the wasps that they came from.
Our next clip is from another of my favorite guests, Dr. Jeff Hammerson, speaking with me about one of his favorite mystery sounds.
And it is a red-legged frog. And Jeff, would you like to tell us a bit about
the call of the northern red-legged frog, which is a common species throughout Washington and in this region especially. Pond that we examined today has a good population of them. One thing about their call is that it might not be something you expect, is that most of the time when the males call, and the call such as you heard, they are submerged underwater. So they're calling underwater, and you might be standing there in the water hearing a frog calling, and your head is right very close to it, but you can't see it. It's because it's underwater, submerged. That's kind of an unusual thing. They're not the only species that does that. Yeah, so that's a sound you hear during the breeding season in winter around here. Kind of late winter, early spring you might hear it, but mostly kind of late winterish. Like I say, only the males will be doing that, and they make those calls to attract females or to interact among themselves. It's kind of like bird song in a way, where two males will sing in nearby territories, and for the frogs they kind of have this social interaction that is partly involves calling and vocalizing, as well as sometimes wrestling with each other.
Uh-huh. This is Mary Robson. Nan spoke about bird language, and at this point, I'm going to share some information about what if the bird made a distress call because it was hurt. And we will be talking with Christy Lassen, who is the owner of Wild Birds Unlimited and studies birds constantly. She will be talking about what to do if you find an injured bird or how injured birds can be treated around here locally.
Well, we are very lucky to have Discovery Bay Wild Bird Rescue in Port Townsend, and they are specifically focused on helping native bird species. They are a very small group. They work with volunteers. Their knowledge and the care and the dedication that they have to saving our local wild birds is pretty remarkable. Cindy and Connor Daly are the owners and the main rescuers. They're amazing. I've seen them help some of the most difficult cases of injured birds. Great blue herons are a good example. They are difficult to rehab. Seabirds are very tough. It's really, honestly, it's Cindy's calling to help these birds. She doesn't give up on tough cases. The center even built their own saltwater recirculating pools to help with native seabirds.
I know that this will make people listening curious about showing up at Discovery Bay Wild Birds. This is not something that we can do, right? It is not open to the public.
They are not open to the public. You know, they run a very tight ship. They built a 100-foot long flight pen for eagles. They relocated a 100-foot enclosure from Yakima and onto their property in Port Townsend and built this amazing structure. They had some problems with it in when we had our Snowmageddon a couple of years ago. Oh. The snow actually collapsed that flight pen, and they, through hard work and fundraising, they raised enough money to have it rebuilt, and it's back up now, and it's amazing. It is such a benefit to any injured raptor, bald eagle. They are so much more likely to be able to be returned to the wild if they can regain flight strength quickly.
I noticed that they have a fascinating website. You can visit it and read stories about the birds they have rescued. And some of the birds, like the eagle that has been there for a long time, do not recover enough to leave back into the wild, but they continue to take care of them.
Their birds that they cannot release become educational ambassadors for the center. And they show people the work that the center does. And they're an important messenger about the challenges that nature faces every day.
Well, and our next is an interview I especially enjoyed back in 2018 with Scott and Susan Freeman about the amazing restoration work they have been doing down on Taribou Creek. And a really special treat is Susan Freeman is actually the granddaughter of Aldo Leopold. And I think all conservationists, ecologists, biologists, and many other folks know Aldo Leopold for his just amazing pioneering work, and of course, the book Sand County Almanac.
Just to start off a little bit, tell me a bit about what inspired you to write the book and what basic story were you wanting to tell?
Well, the basic story goes back a long way when Susan and I first met at the Aldo Leopold Reserve, as a matter of fact, where her grandfather started the project you alluded to a second ago. And we had always dreamed of doing a restoration project like her grandfather and her aunts and uncles and her dad had done back in the 1930s on our own. And when life brought us out to the Pacific Northwest, in 2004, we started looking for a project, and that's when we found Taribou Creek.
The book tells the story of your engagement at Taribou Creek?
It does. Part of the book is about what we were doing as a family and, as it turned out, as a much larger community to work on this watershed. Sort of as an example of what now people call community-based conservation could accomplish. But I also wanted the book to be, and for Susan, for her illustrations, to be about the spirit of why we were doing this, both for ourselves and for the larger community.
Mm-hmm. Before we go too much further in by way of introduction, Scott, let me ask you, and I'll ask Susan the same question, if there's one thing that you want Nature Now listeners to know about you, what would that be?
I'd say about our work in the creek and the work we've done as a family and with the larger community, I'd say the important things we do in life come from the heart. They're things we really love to do and love to leave a legacy for the future. And that, to me, is what we've tried to embody in this book and the project at Taribo Creek.
That's beautiful. And Susan, how would you answer that question?
Well, I think doing this project and doing work on the land, the thing that has meant the most to me is just being outside and being part of a group and just with our family of doing something that makes the world better. And I think that has given me so much strength and stability of my life, that something that I wish that other people could see and do for themselves too.
And just quickly, the book that Scott and Susan Freeman wrote was Saving Taribo Creek, One Family's Quest to Heal the Land. And it's a lovely book. And just a quick reminder, if you turned on the show a little late, we're still celebrating our 500th show using bits and pieces of past shows, our favorite shows, and a few mystery sounds.
We're just hearing about conservation by the dedication of a family. And I want to introduce Robert Michael Pyle, who lives near Grays Harbor and is a local treasure who is also known internationally for his scientific butterfly guidebooks. And he's continuing to publish novels, poetry, essays, song lyrics. And in this particular clip, he defines his conservation ethic, which has gone on with him for more than five decades.
I'm just going to start right in with a question about a way that you did a kind of phrasing. There is a book which is called Through a Green Lens. There's a subtitle that says 50 years of writing for nature.
Right.
And any other writer might have said about. So I thought maybe you could tell us how four carries out the themes of your writing, your thoughts, how you see that word working. It's Thanks. A short word.
It's a short word, and I think a powerful one. Thanks for asking. That took a lot of thought. These days, most nonfiction books of essay, I mean, that's almost duplicating itself, but it's not quite. The essay is a personal form that explicates the feelings and the opinions and the thoughts of the writer, which is not how we were taught essay in the 50s and 60s. We were taught exposition, but when you really learn what an essay is, it's a personal attempt, as it says in French,
to try to
tell something personal about the world. Most of my books have been books of essay. Not all of them are poetry and fiction as well, and science, but this book was a gathering of essays from 50 years. I have a second collection coming from Counterpoint this year called Nature Matrix, and it also goes back 50 years. Each of these begins with an essay that I wrote at the age of 18 or 19. They came forward to essays that have just been written now. And the question was, since most books of essay these days have a title, meant to be a punchy title, followed by a subtitle that tells a little about what it really is, what does one do for that subtitle? Well, we said, let's put the 50 years in there, because that's a little bit shocking that these 50 years of one person's work, and nature should probably be exemplified there after Through a Green Lens, just so we know we're talking about nature, although nature is, of course, everything, which is much of what I write about. And then what about the placement word? And you're right, most people would say writing about nature. But that's all writing. That's a point that I make. There is no writing in the world that's not about nature. There is nothing that is not nature. There's nothing that's not the environment. Writing about nature is a complete redundancy. Writing for nature is a different thing.
The
word for occurred to me that most of what I have done is some kind of a advocacy, either loud advocacy or quiet advocacy. And that's what the four connotes.
Advocacy. Okay. Which is really different than being somewhere who stands there and observes and says, I think I saw a raven this morning.
I do plenty of that, but I do it in the context of recognizing human culpability in change and what we might ought to be thinking about doing about it. I've always been a conservation activist since I was a teenager.
And that essentially places what you are writing now in the context of your values forever.
It does, really. I mean, those have evolved. I used to be a dualist like almost everyone else and think about nature and human affairs as if they were two different worlds. As a student conservationist at the University of Washington, much of what we did in fighting for the North Cascades National Park against the dams in the Grand Canyon, rescuing and taking over the Montlake dump on campus.
That's a wonderful story.
It is a good story.
It has become a site of conservation success.
It's one of the major intra-urban habitats in the country today. But it was in Noysham Marsh when we marched down and took it over. The other students on campus were taking over Lewis Hall and demanding peace and justice. And we were involved in that too during the Vietnam War. But we thought, you know, let's demand topsoil and trees and take over the marsh.
Well, having heard Robert Michael Pyle talk about his advocacy, we're including from 2019, a short chunk of a song he wrote, which is called When the Big Wave Comes, and you will get to hear him at his most dramatic.
When the autumn tides arrive each year, big waves come ashore and wash the beach like a giant sponge. Come winter, the storms hit harder yet and scrape the shoreline clean. When the big wave comes, when the big wave comes. The valleys beyond and the hills above are jealous of that seaside purging. They abide and imagine such a bath as would scour the cumbered continent free of its dirty old blot. When the big wave comes, when the big wave comes.
That is such a fun song. Well, we're nearing the closing of our part two of our 500th show celebration. And it's time to look forward to the future. We are exploring doing more field recordings. And we have Debron with a sample of a recent show in the field.
This next clip is an example of my favorite kind of Nature Now recording when we do get to get out and record in the field. This next clip comes from a field trip that sound engineer Nora Petrich and I took with ecologist Jeff Hammerson this past summer, looking for amphibians and other aquatic life in the ponds near Nora's house.
I'm going to take a sample and see if there are any amphibian larvae on there.
Quite an assortment of, we've got salamander larvae.
Do one more, and then I'll come into the shallower water and join you. Water's actually pretty warm, so I'm quite happy. We have a little ecosystem in the container.
So what have you got, Jeff?
Okay, so we were pretty successful with just three scoops. We have, there's a frog tadpole in here, which is a larval stage, and it's pretty large actually, almost 2 inches long, maybe 1.5 inches. And I'm looking at its eyes because that helps you tell what you're seeing, and they go right out to the far edges of the head. So that's a Pacific tree frog.
Wow. It's a big larva for as small as they are.
Yeah, they're chunky as a larva. As they transform into the little frog stage, they actually shrink somewhat.
Uh-huh.
Of course, they lose all that tail.
Yeah.
So what we're looking at is like 2/3 tail or maybe even more than that.
Uh-huh. How old will that be?
Okay, so that one, remember the frog choruses back in late winter, early spring, like March and April? And you hear at all the little wetlands around the frogs calling very loudly and continuously on the certain nights, like a warm night or after a rain. So that was the breeding event that this originated from. And they spend a few months in the water. And this one's already...
As eggs.
The eggs are only... That stage is short,
uh-huh.
Week or so. And then the larval stage, which we're looking at here, lasts maybe 2 or 3 months, depending on the water temperature,
uh-huh.
And so forth. But this one, you can see, it actually has its hind legs.
The teeny, teeny little hind legs.
Here.
Oh, look how cool that is.
You might be able to make out the expanded toe tips already. So we're looking at a magnifier at the toes. And yeah, those are definitely identifiable as tree frog toes because they have like a wide tip already. So I imagine there are probably hundreds, if not thousands, of those in there. And we just
sample a small part that's relatively deep. So what they would probably be doing is crowding into the shallow, wherever the shallowest parts are when the sun comes out, because warmer, they've developed faster.
We've had all these warm, sunny days, but today is a typical Pacific Northwest day where it's cool and a little bit misty. So they're deeper in the water, right?
Yeah, they're not really, there's no warm shallows today yet.
Doesn't that recording just make you want to go wading in the wetland yourself just to see what you find? That's our aim at Nature Now, to get you excited about the amazing world all around us. And we could do a whole program just recognizing all the wonderful guests that we've had on, and another recognizing all of the partner organizations that have so generously shared their time and expertise with us over the past 10 years. These include federal agencies like the U.S. Forest Service and National Park Service, and it continues on to amazing local and state nonprofit groups like the Washington Native Plant Society, Port Townsend Marine Science Center, and the Jefferson Land Trust. The list is really long, and we have greatly appreciated learning from each and every one of them.
And I want to give thanks to everyone who's been a part of the Nature Now team.
If you want to think about becoming part of Nature Now, a great way to study us is to listen to the older podcasts. There are hundreds of them, and they're fascinating. Go to KPTZ, click on podcasts, go down to Nature Now, and then you can just run around in all of the years that we've been doing shows. It's great fun.
And our closing music today is Celebration. Originally recorded by Kool and the Gang in the early 1980s, this particular recording is wonderful and it's happy, and it's done by a group of international kids called Playing for Change.
Celebrate and have a good time.